Welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a place that brings together people passionate about positive impact.
I guess what I learned from that is I didn't give up, despite, you know, often wanting to give up, because I was passionate and I loved food. But it's all about creating, you know, really beautiful, caring, nurturing working environments to get the best out of people.
My guest today is Merlin LeBron-Johnson, one of the UK's most exciting and socially conscious chefs. Merlin opened his first London restaurant, Portland, in 2015 at just 24 years old. 9 months later, he became the youngest Michelin star British chef. A commitment to sustainability has underpinned his career to date. He was instrumental in launching the Chef's Manifesto, a set of actions aligned with the UN Sustainable Development Goals that address the most pressing food issues. In his spare time, he cooks for refugees and the homeless. We're honored to have Merlin as the Conduit's executive chef. Merlin LeBron-Johnson, welcome to Conduit Conversations.
Hello.
So you grew up in a beautiful part of the world, in South Devon. How did that impact your attitude to food?
So I grew up in a small town called Butfastleigh, where the Riverford Organics company started. And when they were very small, they were just delivering boxes to local families in the community. So we grew up eating beautiful organic vegetables, locally grown from a very early age. Our parents didn't have heaps and heaps of money, and so because of that, we didn't eat a lot of meat or fish, but we always ate good quality locally grown vegetables, cooked simply with love.
And you're beginning to tell us a little bit of your earliest memories of food, but tell us a little bit of what it was like around that table, eating those vegetables, experiencing it in that way. What were your earliest memories?
It was just, you know, the feeling of good food bringing people together was very prominent from an early age.
And when did you realize that you wanted to be a chef?
When I was about 15, yeah, I was still at school. I can tell you the long story if you want.
I want to hear it.
Definitely. Okay. So I went to a very small school called Sands School. I was like many chefs, I was a bit of a troubled youth. I was kicked out of most of my schools, and the only school that would actually take me in the end was called Sands School, and it was a democratic school that I got help from a friend of my parents to go there. And one of the strange things about this school is that lessons were not actually compulsory, and which worked for most of the students, the idea being that if you went to a class, you were committed to be there and you were invested in learning. And but I honestly didn't actually go to that many of the classes, and I found myself just a bit bored a lot of the time. And in the school, there was a fantastic cook who used to cook for the students, and I used to help her in the kitchen in exchange for a free lunch. So I would wash up, peel potatoes, do bits of prep, and she also doubled up as the receptionist. And she would, after a while, she would start to give me the responsibility of preparing lunch for my co-students. So I'd get a little budget of £30, and I'd go down to the shop and buy ingredients, and that was it, really. That I started to get really inspired. I started to think about that as a possibility for a career path. And my teachers were very encouraging, because I'd actually found something I was passionate about, something I loved doing.
Yeah. This is an unlikely setting for somebody who wins a Michelin star. So how did that transition moment happen? Where did that kind of bolt of inspiration that went from an alternative school with organic vegetables, with a loving family, to a sense that you had not just passion, but you also had talent?
It took me a while to figure out that I had talent, but I became instantly passionate about food and cooking, and very quickly went from helping out in the kitchen to getting my first job in a local, actually it was in a local cookery school. And I was probably at that point in my life needing a little bit of discipline and direction. And so I sort of grabbed onto it and held on for dear life, and very quickly decided that I needed to get really good at this. And also I felt like I had something to prove. I'd been sort of so slack and so lazy for most of my life that I was desperate to do something good.
Speaking of doing something good, where did the connection between your passion for food and your obvious talent for it, and then a commitment to sustainability or food for social change, how did that creep into your career?
The social aspect came a little bit later, but I spent 2 years working at a restaurant in Belgium, which was called Inderwolf, a cult restaurant, which is sadly closed now, where they aimed to create a 25-course menu using only products that were grown within a sort of hour's distance of the restaurant. So I learned there about, you know, really close relationships with local farmers, using produce all year round, making the most of what grows in the winter, foraging for wild food, and having a very sort of veg-centric diet and menu because that was the cooking style. The social aspect came later on when I moved to London, which was the first time I lived in a big city. And I was a little bit surprised and overwhelmed by seeing so many people in poverty and feeling more or less helpless to help them. And I think it really dawned on me when I started doing a chef pop-up events, fundraising. I wanted to fundraise for refugees in Calais. So I went out to Calais and I saw a very small kitchen where they were cooking for up to 7,000 refugees every day, distributing meals. And there was just a bunch of different people volunteering from different walks of life who were providing food for these people. No one had told them to do it. They'd independently decided to go and help these people. And I remember it was February. It was absolutely freezing. And the refugee camps in Calais were pretty horrendous. And I remember thinking that, you know, I couldn't see any government aid or intervention, or all it was a bunch of people just trying to help other people. But without those people being there, you know, there was 7,000 people that wouldn't have had food or drink. And even though I was only there for a couple of days, it's impossible to walk away from that sort of situation without feeling like you need to do something. You know, you really connect with it. And that's where it started.
Yeah. And is that what led you to Refettorio Felix and the work that you've done there? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when the Refettorio Felix launched, or the Food for Soul, when I first heard about the Food for Soul project, which is the charity founded by Massimo Bottura, I thought it made such perfect sense. You know, the idea of tackling two major issues in the food system, food waste and people in poverty not having access to food, and combining them but doing something really special and beautiful at the same time was instantly drawing to me. And when they launched in London, I got involved straight away.
So you've been a champion for reducing food waste. What does that mean in practice? Give us some examples of what a chef who's committed to reducing food waste does that a chef who isn't doesn't do.
Well, I think it's about being conscious of every single thing that you do in the kitchen and the impacts that it can have. I think the easiest way for a chef to reduce food waste now is in the planning and creation of a menu. If you start with nothing and you create a menu, you can allow yourself to create a menu that doesn't produce any waste in the first place. A lot of people talk about how to reduce food waste, or how to do less, or how to cut it out. But if you aim to if you strategize and you aim to produce a menu that doesn't actually produce any food waste, then you don't have such a big problem. You know, you can create a menu where if you create one dish that has a sort of surplus or that has an element of food waste, you create another dish on that menu to use up that food waste. And it's all about being creative with, you know, finding creative and also delicious solutions to using up the food waste. Any non-edible, non-consumable, the end food waste that can't be rescued should always go into compost. And we pass it, you know, in the restaurants, we've always passed it back to farmers who use that compost to grow vegetables that then sell them back to us, thus completing the cycle.
So tell us about how this commitment has in fact influenced your food style. Has your commitment to eliminating food waste, to thinking more sustainably, to thinking about how food can be used to address hunger, has it actually influenced your style as a chef?
Yes, very much so. I think before I was just cooking, you know, ambitious food that I learned to cook in other fancy restaurants, which you know, won awards and was exciting, and you know, it's, but ultimately was expensive food for very privileged people. And when you cook in a restaurant like that, you can sort of do what you want. You know, you can buy the finest lobster and the finest asparagus, and it's almost cheating, really. You've got access to the world's greatest ingredients, and then, you know, you've got a beautiful kitchen and a great team, and of course it's going to be good. But it doesn't really stand out, and it doesn't have identity, because you're ultimately doing the same thing as everyone else. And I think when you have restrictions, when you're forced to be more creative, you know, by only using British ingredients or by trying to have a zero waste menu, you start to think outside the box and you come up with much more creative and inspiring solutions and dishes and ideas than you would have ever found before. At the beginning, it's difficult. You know, you think, what am I going to do? How am I going to cook Swiss chard or kale, you know, all year round? Because that's pretty much all that grows in England. And then you end up doing the most exciting and interesting dishes with Swiss chard or kale that no one else would have ever done, because they wouldn't have been forced to do that. And it creates a different and a more raw and a more unique cooking style, I think.
So what's it like for a kid who, you know, by his own account had a more challenging childhood and had to find his own path to discover that you've won a Michelin star?
Yeah, it was a shock. it was totally unexpected. So a shock is the first word that springs to mind, but also, you know, I felt very proud and very excited for the team. Yeah, a bit overwhelmed. It took me a while to sort of come to terms with it.
Tell us a little bit about a dish that you think is inspiring or delicious that you've done in the past or just last week, just something that you looked at, that you created, and that you thought, I'm really proud of that dish.
Oh, good. It's a difficult one. I think as a chef, you're never quite satisfied with what you've produced. So to be really proud of something is rare. You know, you almost have to take a step back and look at it from someone else's perspective, because when you're in the process and when you're doing it, it's hard to ever be satisfied. But I think as I've sort of matured as a chef and started to think about food differently, I've become more and more excited about cooking vegetables. And there's something that I've done with different root vegetables in the winter when we're getting desperate and running out of ideas, which is to cook whole roots. So take a swede or a celeriac, for example, and we make a salt crust. So it's like water, salt, and flour, and we wrap the entire root in the crust. And recently, we've been using the leftover coffee grinds from the bars at the Conduit to add into that crust. So it's got a sort of coffee flavor. And what happens is when you wrap the root in the crust and you bake it in the oven, the crust hardens a bit like a bread crust, and it retracts away from the root. And as the root cooks, it creates steam, which then mixes with the coffee and the salt in the crust and falls back down onto the root, which seasons it as it cooks. And after about 2 hours, you've got this beautiful, shiny, sort of glistening orb of celeriac, which you can then either roast as a steak, and it's a beautiful way to kind of replace meat in a, you know, in a, it feels like you're eating a beautiful meat, but you're actually got a nice, salty, slightly coffee-infused celeriac steak, which we serve with toasted nuts and a fresh cheese. But what you can also do is take that root and dry it, so dehydrate it, remove all the moisture from it, and it becomes a little bit shriveled up, and then slice it very thinly, and the salt sort of concentrates, and you end up with like a vegetable ham, like a plant-based ham. Anyway, pretty proud of that one.
Sounds extraordinary. Be sure to tell me when you get that on the menu again. So you've crammed a lot of experience into the first few years of your career, and you've worked in acclaimed restaurants across Europe as well as London. And I'm sure you've had your not just great successes, but challenges and failures. And one of the things we're trying to do in this conversation is take highly accomplished and successful people and get them to reflect on challenges and failures, not just successes, because that's very helpful to people who are embarking on their own careers and their own journey. So any of your challenges or failures or lessons that you'd be keen to share?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you asked me at the beginning of our chat about when I realized that I was passionate and talented, and I said that actually the two were, there were different moments. And the first perhaps 5-6 years of my career, I was passionate, but I was also probably not that talented, and I really struggled, especially working in kitchens around Europe, where, you know, being a young English chef who didn't speak perfect French, and you know what, you know, even just the fact that I was British was already a challenge, and so I sort of, I guess, in many ways, suffered from the stereotypical kind of bullying and kind of all the hardships you hear about in the sort of Michelin star kitchen, old school Michelin star kitchens. And it wasn't till I found myself in a slightly more experimental environment in Inderwolf in Belgium, where I was just treated a little bit differently in the kitchens. You know, there was an international team, people from all over the world were working there, and the chef and the kitchen leader was very inspiring, and really gave us a voice and didn't make us feel like we were terrible at what we did, and said thank you and was kind. And there was a sort of an ambience of kindness in the kitchen that sort of gave me a confidence I didn't have before. And as soon as I was given that sort of, as soon as someone was nice to me, ultimately, I sort of propelled me, and I grew very quickly as a chef, and became, was quickly promoted. And then from there, I went to London to open my first restaurant, and it all happened very fast. And I guess what I learned from that is, well, I didn't give up, despite, you know, often wanting to give up, because I was passionate and I loved food. But it's all about creating, you know, really beautiful, caring, nurturing working environments to get the best out of people, you know. And that's something that I, when I opened my restaurants, it's something that I was always very conscious of, taking interest in my staff, finding out where they want to be, and making sure that they feel looked after, cared for, and getting them there.
So I can attest to the fact, because I eat in your restaurant an inordinate amount of time, and we have an open kitchen, and I watch you and the team work. And it does strike me that you have both a camaraderie and an atmosphere of both, you know, civility and kindness in the kitchen. Is that something that you've implemented at the Conduit? Is that the way you run your kitchen?
That's definitely the way I run my kitchen. I think going back to what I was saying before, it struck me at some point that, you know, I'd been working in kitchens for God knows how many years, and no one had ever sat down with me and asked me if I was happy, or, you know, where I was trying to get to. And having that ongoing dialogue with our employees is vital in creating a, you know, a better kitchen space, a better kitchen environment, but also in retaining staff, you know, because if they feel like you're invested in them, they will stay and they will work harder for you. It also came naturally because I have a brilliant head chef, Ben, who lives and breathes everything that I've just said. And we were very selective with the employment process, making sure we only had those kind of people in our kitchen from the beginning, so that can grow and blossom that sort of that ambience. Yeah.
So what advice would you give to a younger version of your current self embarking on a career, wanting to be a great chef, knowing everything that you know now about the industry, but also the way the world is moving and turning?
I would say the most important thing is always to work hard. The three most important things is hard work. You know, if you work harder than everybody else, you will be noticed. The second most important thing, or just as important as hard work, is to be nice to people. You know, if you're the hardest working person in the room, but you're also nice and humble, number three, you'll be fine. You know, that's the main advice I'd give to anybody starting out as a cook. Work hard, be humble, be nice. You'll be fine.
So I think it's fair to say that our food at the Conduit has sort of kicked off with a bang. It's been extraordinarily well received, and we're just a little over 6 months in, so it's still early days. But if you were to project out to 2 or 3 years from now and sort of say, what would your fantasy be for how we offer our food across the entire club and to our community, what would success look like?
Yeah, I think we're already definitely on the right track. I think to just continue what we're currently doing with the food program, but really find our style, which isn't always immediate, you know, because you have to listen to what the guests want. You have to build important and meaningful relationships with the producers and the growers. You have to create an exciting point of difference between each food offering, and you have to nurture a team of people who are really passionate and caring about what they do and excited to be working here. I think we're building an incredible guest chef program, which we're about to launch this year, which sees some of the most exciting, diverse group of chefs from around the world coming to join us, and I think that will only grow over the years. We were talking yesterday about hosting a vegetarian week across the restaurant, and maybe a vegetarian day across the club, which I hope we can perhaps do every month, or at least on a regular basis, and really start to enlighten ourselves and other people about the the beauty of plant-based cooking and how, you know, and how we don't need to eat as much meat and fish, which we're already working on across the menus. Yeah, and the drinks program is already incredible. We have one of the most exciting and diverse, definitely in Mayfair, diverse wine lists and incredible cocktails. So I think we're on the right track.
You often stress the power of provenance and sourcing. Tell us a story about one of our suppliers that you think is just remarkable about not just what they produce, but perhaps the story behind them.
Yeah, my top supplier, which I've raved about for the last few years, are actually very close friends of mine. I grew up in the same town as them, and I was best friends with their son at primary school. So he's probably the friend that I still have that I've known for the longest. In fact, he helped me with my banquet for refugees a couple of days ago. But his parents, they run a project called the Husbandry School, where they teach people about the ancient arts of sort of sustainable land management and animal husbandry. And they also work with children who have been through the care system. So who've been, you know, troubled children who've been in foster care or hostel, or who've been kicked out of school, who've sort of struggled in society and almost been rejected by society as problematic or
or violent, and they take these children, they aim to re-engage them and re-inspire them through having them work with the land and work with animals. You take a kid who's apparently, you know, violent and dangerous, and you put him in a field with a bunch of baby goats overlooking Dartmoor, and you see such an incredible change, and it's been a really successful project. They're getting funding to grow. And a byproduct of this incredible work is the most incredible meat and vegetables that I've ever cooked with in my whole career. They're super passionate about reintroducing heritage and forgotten varieties of herbs and vegetables, and also rare breed pigs and goats and sheep. And we get a weekly delivery, and they don't really supply any other restaurants apart from us. And it is truly the most astonishing vegetables. And another thing that they were doing recently was they don't use any pesticides, or it's all totally natural farming. And they've been using these South American tubers, which are indigenous to South America, like oca roots and mashua, partly because they're delicious and partly because they're not so susceptible to pests. In fact, the pests, because they're so foreign, they completely ignore them. So what they've started doing is they're planting circles of these tubers around their more vulnerable crops, so that when the pests arrive to sort of attack their vulnerable crops, they're met with this force field of delicious tubers that they're just completely uninterested in, and they just go elsewhere. And they also have these incredible Chinese runner ducks that are tall and thin and look hilarious, that sort of waddle in between the plants and eat the pests off the leaves of the plants. So yeah, they're definitely the most inspiring supplier.
A force field of ochre roots.
I
never thought I would hear those words together.
And they are totally delicious and unusual and beautiful.
So let me ask you, I sense that you have a vision for a food system that is different to the one that we have today, and that you are at the vanguard of a movement of people who are cooking into that future. What's that future look like?
It's difficult to say what that future looks like. I think that slowly, as consumers and cooks and people are becoming more and more aware of the impact our eating and dining choices are having on the environment, and you know, sometimes socially as well. And I'm a firm believer that influential people in food are the people that are listened to when they're addressing key issues in the food system. People don't like to listen to politicians, scientists, statistics. It all goes a bit over their head. But if you get someone like, I don't know, Jamie Oliver stepping up and saying, you know, this is a big problem, we need to change it, the impact that has is huge. So I think that little by little, by speaking up about these issues and setting examples, we can make changes. I don't know what the future looks like. I don't want to think about what the future looks like, but it's important to address and talk about these issues, and also, you know, lead by example. And I think chefs are the perfect vehicles for this.
Merlin LeBron Johnson, thank you so much for joining me on Conduit Conversations.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. The podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find more information on The Conduit and our community of inspiring changemakers.